And I'm Dr. Merit Trelstad from Pacific Lutheran University, and I teach, my position is constructive theology and Lutheran theology. Constructive is the term for systematic theology they're using. By that, when they chose that job title, they were saying they wanted a systematician who wasn't stuck in orthodoxy. That was basically why they used the word constructive. So, and that makes sense in the Pacific Northwest. You kind of have to have, the students, you know, just don't get all the orthodoxy and doctrine stuff. That doesn't really fly. They want to kind of talk about it in a different way. So that's my position there. And a couple of you have been here diehards throughout the week. I am so impressed. So I think what I'd like to do is we'll go through and stop and look at these and talk about these, Luther's theology and its impact on women. And then what we'll do is take that time to, whether it's in relation to women or whether it's in relation to anything we've talked about in the week, just say, are there themes either out of Lutheran theology or Christian theology that you find particularly helpful for either helping you conserve, by conserving conservatism and being conservative up there? I really meant that idea of being traditional and conservative, and not in a pejorative way, but in a positive way, because there's a tradition that should be nursed and nurtured. And then other, on the flip side, are there parts of the Christian tradition, Lutheran tradition, that you find inspiring for social action and change? So I'm turning that over to you. I wanted to bring up, in looking at Luther's theology and its impact on women, it's almost hard for me to put this together because it's like breathing for me. I've thought about it for so long and kind of written about it and been in these conversations for some time. So, and when I put it together, I realized that my PowerPoint brings up most of the potentially harmful things about Lutheran theology with women. So before I get started on my stuff, I thought, too late to go back and change that. But let me say this. There's a book. They were out of it in the bookstore, so I went to go to try to find a copy of it for you, and they ran out a couple weeks ago. But it's called Transformative Lutheran Theologies. And the editor is this Mary Streifert, and even if you can't see the board so well, you could come up and take a look at it. In there, it's all women, women Lutheran theologians. Not all of the women would claim the term feminist for themselves, but we wanted to have some addition where women were working constructively and creatively with Luther's topics. Because, for example, there have been two edited, and there are lots of women right now doing very interesting things with Lutheran theology. And making those connections together, it's finally kind of going public. So in 2009, there was the first real Lutheran feminist, womanist, Muharista theology conference in Chicago. And so 2009, it's a long time.
You know? They've been having little ones in
little
San Francisco,
ones.
But not a big one.
Yeah. Yeah, little gatherings of people, but yeah, and so I think it is the more people kind of coalesce, I think, the more that material gets out there, because there have been a couple edited volumes that have been out recently by men, edited by men, and that don't even mention any of the work done by women in Lutheran theology. So it's one of those things where you're like, huh, well, you kind of missed a few things that are going on, you know, that's not exactly the total of, but this one, so some of those positive things, for example, I'll come back and take a look at these, bring up a couple of their names, either in that book. I included a few in my book, Cross Examinations, which is an edited volume, a few of these people, and how they're working with Martin Luther. So I will bring them up as we go along. Mary Lowe is the only one who... doesn't directly relate to any of the topics, but Mary Lowe is doing some really interesting work on queering Luther. She's a queer theologian, and that's what she titles herself. So she's a lesbian woman, and she's saying that Luther Luther's kind of upending of all the kind of terms of his day go very well with postmodern thought and kind of this dismantling and upsetting power structures and kind of easy ways of thinking. And she does some really interesting things with that. And she's a very engaging, she really like performs when she lectures. So she is far more interesting than me. I love going to Mary Lowe's lectures. So she has a rendering hand signals and stuff, you know. So she's pretty interesting. If you want one of these sheets, you may take it. Again, I've been handing that same sheet out all week of Luther's theology, but I'll have little bits of it up here anyway. So if you want to have it, you can. So I'll give a little bit of background, and then we'll go from there to look at those specific categories on that sheet and some of the positive ideas in reference to here and some of the potential downfalls of Luther's theology in relation to feminist theology of the last 40 years. So Reformation advances and their downsides. So it shouldn't be number one at the top, but I couldn't figure out on PowerPoint how to move it exactly and retain the bullet point. But Luther did advocate beating one's wife if she didn't understand her place. There are some terrible quotes on this. So there's one of my colleagues who's not Lutheran, wrote a book on marriage and has a whole, and Christian marriage and Christian ideas of marriage over the years, and she has the Reformation section with Calvin and Luther just have some horrific things. Of course, we have beautiful plays, understandings, everything of Katie and Martin Luther as though they're this perfect couple in the Reformation times. We have no evidence that Luther beat Katie. She seems always in our modern depictions as a very strong, capable woman and yada, yada, yada. So we have no idea, but he certainly, when talking about marriage, said, you know, if women don't understand their place, this is acceptable and should be used because it's important. Everyone has their place, and especially women are submissive to men. And that's where the rule of thumb comes, you know, but you cannot beat your wife with anything that's thicker than your thumb. So that's, but thumb and smaller, you're okay. You know, it's humane, I guess. So, that's a good murmur in the crowd. So, the education, this is another thing at PLU, education is extended to all. Samuel Torvent is in my department. I love Samuel Torvent. And he loves talking about how in the Reformation you get this great advance of public education, which is absolutely true. Women, girls get to go to school because they need to be taught to read the Bible and go to catechism. This is the underlying motivation. So to have an educated laity. However, after the equivalency of an eighth grade education, women were cut off from educational opportunities. You could say, well, sure, but wouldn't that be normal back then? Well, what it does stop is the few women who go to the convent. In the Catholic system, you could go to the convent, or your family might take you to the convent, or if you're a privileged woman, you might go to the convent, and there your educational possibilities were limitless. And so you had these great theologians of the medieval times in the Roman Catholic Church, like Hildegard von Bingen, who's writing her theology and sending it to the Pope. And you had a number of big women, writers and thinkers, and whose work was out there and in the church imagination. But in Protestantism, you get education to a point, and then after that, we have no women doing theology for 400 years. So that's kind of a loss. You don't have a female voice. So there's something to, but I was thinking, there's what I think is funny about this. So there's some nuns that, by God, did not want to be liberated from their convent. They had made a religious oath, and they were going to be nuns no matter what those Protestants did. And there's stories of French nuns marching over the Alps to freedom, you know, so that they could remain nuns. They did not want to be pastors' wives or get married. It's a violation of their oath and their calling and their vocation. So it wasn't all the sound of music, is what I'm trying to say. And like, that's like a Protestant romance tale. Like, every nun wanted to leave, you know, and be a housewife. And it's like, they didn't. And it was great for some, and for others it was not liberating. So the new role of pastor's wife, this is raised in a lot of texts as being, of course, the priests weren't married. And so now you have this new job, in a way, of pastor's wife. And a number of historic texts talking about the Reformation talk about this as a great liberating vocation and move. And the sanctification of childcare as a vocation, that is, you know, in Luther's idea of the priesthood of all believers and the calling of vocation, this calling to parenthood is equivalent to the priesthood. It's equivalent to all things. It's a holy calling. And so there is a great sanctification of the home, and that's men and women working at home and working with children and their rearing. It's the most important thing, Luther says. And he even throws in at one point kind of a barb saying, you men and women, you know, who disregard childcare and giving your children a proper Christian upbringing, he almost says, like, you're endangering your salvation. He makes that kind of a step. And it's a shocking one for him, of course, because works aren't supposed to do anything about salvation. But occasionally he slips in these things. It's like, what did you say? Like, that's not what you're supposed to say. But you have this sanctification, and so it's a very nice thing. And he has beautiful imagery of that, of the mother holding her child in the middle of the night, of the father changing diapers, and how this is a wonderful thing that should not be downgraded. So Luther's ideas of women's job in paradise, however, can sound rather odd to some modern ears. Women are to bear young, this is their primary calling, and to stay at home. To the extent, he says, that they would need to find a new partner if their husband cannot produce offspring. He actually does write this. He says, this is so much a God-driven, ordained vocation of women that if your husband and you are not able to have children, your husband should graciously allow you to go with somebody else to get pregnant, but you don't have to mention it. He does say it's not, and that man and the husband should honor that arrangement, but not make it public. It doesn't need to be public, but women need to. They need to do this. This is a calling. So positive, negative. You know, there's a, you can weigh that. But it's pretty. It gets a little extreme at points. He does talk about, of course, women are like a. Nail driven into the wall. I had mentioned this before. They stay at home. These are the quotes my students like to read. And they're like, oh! Yeah. And you're an old maid if you're a woman and you're not married by 15, 16, and a man by 18. And there are all these, you know, 20-year-olds sitting there who have missed their calling already. So women aren't allowed. And in Protestant cities, women are also removed from the front of the business store. They are not allowed to work in storefronts. I'm not exactly sure why, but this was across the board. Calvinist areas and Lutheran areas, women could work maybe in the back of the business, but you couldn't own it or be out in the front in the shop anymore. And essentially, it was the idea that women could be housewives or sell goods on the street. And
why is the selling on the street part okay?
Yeah. Well, he's, to me, it sounds like a, is the word double entendre? What is the word, you know, to sell your goods on the street?
Those goods.
Yeah, I don't know what he's talking about. But he's not pro-prostitution. He's really disturbed that women, that his seminary students are going to prostitute. So he's not pro-prostitution. But every time I read that as a woman, I'm like, what are those goods these women are selling on the streets? I suppose it could be your produce.
From home.
Like, yeah, something you made.
But it seems like a woman would be more protected
in the shop
with her spouse than out on the street where, you know, more vulgarity might be occurring and things.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the tradition of the fishermen's wives. The fishermen bring in the fish, but it's their wives who sell the fish on the docks. You go down to the pier, down to the docks, and that's where you get the fish, and it's the fishermen's wives who are selling it.
Right, so there could be all kinds of things. I always trip over it, but you're coming up with better. So I put reduction of job possibilities. So the Protestant Reformation led to a change in women's vocation, at least. But a hallowing of the one at home. Luther has really funny visions of paradise. At least they're really funny to me. And Rosemary Ruther, who's a feminist, kind of grandma of feminist theology, she's hilarious when she talks about this. She's just like, oh yeah, she has this big voice and this huge laugh. And she just says, you know, he just envisions women walking around and dropping babies. They're just dropping them all the time, like eggs. And they're just, you know, the kids are just jumping up and running off. And the women are just kind of continue having, they're kind of giving birth constantly. Because this is such a joy. And it can be, but I just think, oh, it's so funny. That's what you have to look forward to.
What was Luther's own family structure? Lots of kids?
Lots of kids. Once he got married, he got married. They got married and had lots of kids. So I think they had six that survived. Someone else might be able to correct me on this, but one of his two that died, and his daughter Magdalena was about 12, and she died. And some credit that as actually, some say he's a little bit older in his life. He's in his 40s when his daughter Magdalena dies, and some say that's after that, he becomes all crotchety and starts writing all those awful things about the Jews and things like that. He really takes it to heart. So it's not that he doesn't have a very tender place for the women in his life. And his daughter. His daughter meant quite a bit to him. So. But they do have a big, busy household. And they are selling their, to kind of run a hostel and sell beer. Unlike Holden. No. Paul's been looking for a beer after the hike. All right, so into some of these ideas that are on the sheet. In Luther's theology of the cross, Luther's idea should be, my own personal rampage is that it should be called an epistemology of the cross. An epistemology is just how you know. It's just the method of knowing. So maybe you know through your senses, maybe you know through your experience, through tradition, through education, through all kinds of different forms. So Luther says that God is known in the cross. And what the cross shows us is that God is known in the fallenness, in the place that you'd least look for God. So in public humiliation and shame on the cross and execution, and vulnerability and powerlessness and all of these things, that it turns the world's expectations upside down. And so he brings that up, that God is known in the least likely of places in the cross. And so that God is not revealed in power perfection, and I have down there complicated thinking, things like that. A couple of the women who have gone into that idea and appreciatively have been Cynthia Moe Labida, Deanna Thompson, Mary Stoyford have written on that, of talking about, Cynthia Moe Labida talks about how in Latin America, viewing the world from the underside is very much of a Latin American liberation theology idea, that you begin with the experience of the poor and the oppressed, and that's where you look for God, rather than in the systems of oppression and power. Deanna Thompson also approaches it like that, so that embracing that idea of God known in the vulnerable, and so for women or for others who may be oppressed, that is where we should listen for the voice of God and things like that. Mary Stoyford has an interesting idea that's somewhat related on suffering, and that God's suffering is not like taking passive abuse, but rather like the suffering which brings birth. It's a productive suffering kind of idea, but it surrounds the idea. It's suffering that produces life rather than suffering for suffering's sake. So he works with the idea of the cross and suffering as well. Potential issues for women in Luther's theology of the cross are actually, I would say, if you look down here, this is almost better. I think the problem lies more with Luther's understanding of atonement more than this epistemology. But the cross symbol is potentially dangerous for sufferers of oppression, and I can read that. I can read a little bit on that. The person who talks about it being an epistemology of the cross, who I should have up here too, is Mary Solberg, who's at Gustavus. And she also works with Latin American liberation theology, and she talks about once one learns to view things from the underside, that it calls us to ethics. And so ethics begins with that epistemology of the cross, and she is very insistent it's an epistemology of the cross. So she's also a very interesting thinker. Potential issues for women there. The emphasis on the cross in general and traditional atonement theories. And atonement theories would be like, I even had a handout on that, but like vicarious atonement, that Jesus passively suffers so that others are redeemed, and that what is redemptive that Jesus does is take suffering and die. Then that aspect of it, and suffer violence. Several feminist theologians in the last 15 years have talked about how these understandings of how atonement is produced could valorize suffering as a necessary thing to experience Christ, to be Christ, thereby doubling the suffering already experienced by domestic violence survivors who feel as though passive suffering of violence is their cross to bear for others. And this is something that I have worked with in particular because I had a course on pastoral care and counseling with women. And they did talk about in those cycles of domestic violence, they also said that the most common phrase heard in emergency rooms across the country by domestic violence sufferers or survivors is, "This is my cross to bear." And it just made me start thinking about how traditionally, you know, we have the image of the cross as being this redemptive thing, but also kind of the damage the symbol can do. And then understandings of the symbol and how salvation is brought about. Last time I taught at Holden, we spent a whole week on just different images of the cross. Very appreciative understandings of the cross and how it can check kind of capitalist Christianity and things like that by kind of the theology of the cross ideas. But also bringing up a lot of womanist theology, African-American women, theologians like Dolores Williams. She made a famous talk years and years and years ago, but she where she said, for African American women, this image of passive suffering as being redemptive is incredibly damaging, and substitutionary suffering, like I'll suffer on behalf of you, because she said, because we've done it. We were forced to like bear the children, nurse the children, do the work, and the idea of having to bear that and the impact that has on our psyche and has had in our history is so damaging that we have to shift understandings of salvation to Easter morning or somewhere else in the Christian understanding, but not having the cross be the redemptive part. And that can sound pretty extreme, I think, to some Christians, but it's kind of an interesting thing that's out there. And Luther definitely has the vicarious atonement idea, and Bonhoeffer does as well. Bonhoeffer carries this idea, you know, that Christ bears and suffering, and therefore we should bear the suffering. But here's the thing that I guess some people have said is, if people are in power and are able to choose suffering, that's one thing. To say, like, I choose to bear suffering on behalf of my neighbor because I have the privilege to choose it. But if it's just being shoved on you, is that redemptive as well, to suffer, suffer, suffer? And so that idea of, like, in what context is suffering, can suffering lead to anything redemptive is a big question. One of the books, so the people who have kind of exploded that question, I have one of their books up here. But Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca Ann Parker have a book called Proverbs of Ashes, Violence, Redemptive Suffering, and the Search for What Saves Us. In another book of theirs later, they talk about, it's called Saving Paradise. And it talks about early Christians finding redemptive images in images of baptism and water and paradise, not the cross. So they talk, they in their book, whether it's historically accurate or not, I won't argue on that, they say they went looking for the cross in early Christian art because they've had a problem with the cross because they were working with women who were domestic violence survivors or had been, or themselves had experienced it. So they said they went looking for the cross and could not find it. And it is like the Easter, it's like the women on Easter morning, and it kind of how they tell their story. And they said, we looked everywhere, and we could find Jesus, you know, doing the Eucharist, maybe. But oftentimes it was Jesus' Paschal lamb with waters of paradise flowing and the shepherd's staff, and like that these were the images of redemption. And so they link the rise of the cross to Constantine, and imperial Christianity, militaristic in Christianity. So once Constantine gets a hold of Christianity as a military power, the cross rises to prominence. That's there, and especially in the medieval times around Luther and Calvin. So that's their thesis they're arguing in their book. So it's an interesting, I don't know if it's right exactly, but it's just interesting, and I can't get it out of my head as like, well, that's an interesting thing to think about. Yeah.
Can they make the argument that the cross, the Roman cross, is actually a symbol of Sol Invictus, of the rays of the sun coming down?
They don't do that. They don't do that.
I have read that.
They really don't like the cross.
So what book is that?
Saving Paradise is their other book, but this is their, I do have a quote in here. I can pass that around, but a quote in here from them. So one of the things they say, I think I can find this. I can find it right here. Good job. All right, so this is what Rebecca Ann Parker writes. I put, Parker describes her own shift from believing in sacrificial atonement models in the following words. And she was a pastor. I recognized that Christianity had taught me that sacrifice is a way of life. I forgot the neighbor who raped me, but I could see that when theology presents Jesus' death as God's sacrifice of his beloved child for the sake of the world, it teaches that the highest love is sacrifice. To make sacrifice or be sacrificed is virtuous and redemptive. And she writes, but what if this is not true? What if nothing or very little is saved? What if the consequence of sacrifice is simply pain, the diminishment of life, fragmentation of the soul, abasement, and shame? What if severing of life is merely destructive of life and not the path of love, courage, trust, and faith? What if performance of sacrifice is a ritual in which some human beings bear loss and others are protected from accountability or moral expectations? So they go at that in a very different way. So here, I'm not necessarily saying Luther's epistemology of the cross or his way of understanding God. That, I think, can have some real potential for women, but the cross as a symbol has become highly problematic. I mean, it's in the last 20 or so years. Any other thoughts on that before we go on, actually, on questions or thoughts?
No, only that I just thought as you were talking here about problems of the cross, sort of it's interesting in popular culture, it seems like there's sort of been a sort of hyper-sexualization of the cross too, with uses in popular music.
Yeah.
It's just something
else.
It has
a bazillion, I mean, there's the cross as a symbol and then there's atonement models, and these are almost two separate things of like how salvation is done by God. And then this cross is a symbol of, when you think of burning crosses on lawns, and the cross is really highly charged as a symbol, a really powerful redemptive symbol, or a symbol of suffering, or, you know, a pop symbol that has a number of different things. It's so, but like symbols, you can't really control their use. So one of my, Susan Dunphy Nelson, who's now a Lutheran, so I wasn't going to bring her up, but she said, well, I have to figure out as a feminist how to work with the cross because it's not going away. And I said, well, that's a good point. You know, so you got to do something with it.
with the focus in that theology epistemology of this cross and finding that somehow at the center of human existence. If you extend the atonement theory out to beyond the talk about sacrifice to what satisfaction theory, where you focus more on why was this required? It was required because, and I can't remember if this came up before or after the Lutheran, like Bernard of Clairvaux's in my brain. So when was satisfaction theory?
Yeah, earlier. Okay. I mean,
you know, it was because this righteous God demanded payment for a debt, essentially.
Oh yeah.
And so then the image of God that goes along with that is, first of all, a masculine image, usually, of this righteous, masculine deity who requires suffering of someone. And so that's the image that's also packed into the atonement theories that you're talking about, I think. And that is problematic for women. Because that's projected in so many ways. But what is your God like? Is your God someone who demands violence and who demands suffering and sacrifice? And who is this? And are all the masculine power figures in your life somehow deriving their power from that God?
From that sacrifice, too. So C.S. Lewis is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Yeah, it's a nice book, and it's kind of fun to have my kids read, C.S. Lewis, but there is that kind of thing of, like, it's right, Lewis really has a strong image of this, right? Aslan has to be killed, and there's the trick in the killing. So the devil or the white witch doesn't know, but, once the Aslan is taken or the bait is taken, then the devil's undone, and it's a... But it is an interesting idea that, so Anselm came up with this idea, but hot on his heels is Abelard, who says just what we're saying of saying, boy, first off, God doesn't owe the devil anything. Why would God have to pay the devil something? It challenges God's sovereignty. So God doesn't owe the devil. God could just do it if God is powerful. And also that Jesus' death there is seen as a result of love. So Jesus so loves the disciples that Jesus goes through this and becomes an exemplar of love, and the suffering is, and so it's a moral exemplar model where we also then are willing to take that up. And it's a bit Bonhoeffer-y there on that. Like, so for the sake of the neighbor and for the sake of love, I am willing to suffer. If it needs
the suffering
to be
demanded.
Yes, but the suffering itself is not necessary in Abelard's model. So, it may come, but it's not necessary. But it's a whole can of worms, isn't it? So there's a million things that are involved in that conversation of who kills Jesus, why he died. In any church basement, if you just start with those questions, who killed Jesus and why did he die and did he have to die? You'll hear all the atonement models within 10 minutes. It's really, so people know who killed Jesus alone. The Romans, God, the devil, us, me. It's like we know all of the answers, but you can't really have the Romans and the devil and God all in the same mix. That's the problem, is we've got this hodgepodge of ideas. It's like, wait a minute. Well, who are you going to decide on this? Like, which model goes best, do you think? So it's a fascinating conversation. I can, any other thoughts on that before I go?
I'm thinking about all the sacrifice that was required in the Old Testament of all of the animals that had to be sacrificed. And I thought that Jesus' sacrifice ended all of the need for killing goats and whatever. Why is the demand for any sacrifice of any life
necessary anymore?
Animal.
And the with Jesus' role in there, there's a theologian, this S. Mark Hine, who does great work with Rene Girard's idea of cyclical violence and how societies deal with conflict, and it's usually through this climax of violence and the sacrifice, and then you move on. So, and how Jesus's death should be understood in that context of it being the end of violence. It should be the end of sacrificial suffering. So that's his he kind of takes that idea of this is the end and should be the end, and works that into his contemporary theology while acknowledging some of the problems. So saying, right, actually, I don't think we should talk about sacrificial violence now, but it was effective then. At which Rita Brock, who wrote the other book, is going around. I had them on a panel at the American Academy of Religion, and while he was giving his talk, she looks over at me and goes, like, just is rolling her eyes. It was so interesting. I've never actually been at it. Usually people are very cool and rational at the American Academy of Religion. No, it's not emotive. But everyone was packed into this hot room, and it was packed, like standing room. People want to talk about the cross and its meaning. And out the door, and he was talking, and it was hot, and the speakers were shaking their heads at each other. You know, I was like, oh, this is great. I mean, this is the best you could expect, is to have a real conversation with very different ideas presented. It was fascinating. So that's kind of one of my passions, is that conversation. We already did that. So we will move down. Let's see. Funny way that it's... So, sola scriptura on your sheet. Luther talks about this literal reading of scripture, by which when we talked about it on Monday, we talked about he means, and he really, I'm not making it up, he really means he wants a plain reading. But he's a biblical translator. He knows that, you know, you can choose this word or this word in German or in English, you know, to translate it. And that's not going to be the English word that God used, and so those translation issues. He wants a plain reading that doesn't overlay Greek philosophical assumptions onto the text, and he's reacting to the method of interpretation that these scholastic theologians used. He's not advocating a literal reading how we use the term today. He's a translator. And then we had mentioned before, he states that if God does not have feathers, even if the Bible says God is a mother hen. So that's his example, one of his examples of, I don't mean that. I mean, let's read the Bible and allow plain, ordinary people with a basic education to read the Bible. It's safe in their hands. They can read it. They can understand it. It's accessible. They don't need a fancy degree and to argue crazy things like how many angels dance on the head of a pin and things like that. And so, but today, that literal reading, that out of context of the whole scripture, can be understood to, I mean, we've heard that, right? So I almost don't even need this slide, to advocate women's submission, silence, absence, and leadership positions, etc., used as a proof text to undermine women's authority and leadership and family in the church. In the Lutheran tradition in particular, when we have sola, if we say sola scriptura and word, word is the one place and the one source of authority for all theology, life of the church, worship, then we do by default, at least for the lead source of authority, reason or tradition, societal experience and church experience and women's experience are potentially not seen as authoritative sources for theology. So the other night when I said that I had a seminary professor say feminist theology, liberation theology, black theology, these are not theologies. I think this is what he meant by it, was if you're saying that we begin with kind of women's experience, which has been a feminist, womanist way of talking about, instead of beginning with kind of the normative male experience, we begin with interpreting and thinking about theology in light of our experience. Well, if you come from a Lutheran tradition where they say experience, since when is that a source of authority? Scripture. Yes. So there's a potential difficulty there. Any thoughts or questions?
To what extent did Luther read, it was his plain literal reading done out of context? I mean, I know that he really read Psalms and the Old Testament as fulfillment for Christ. He really read Christ into it, and he saw these texts as applicable to our situation today and was reading it for how it speaks to us today. But to what extent did he consider context in his reading?
That's a great question. I don't know if I... I think tradition was important, and reason and philosophy, he was schooled in that.
Yeah.
But the idea of a historical context, I don't think they were asking that question until our century. But would you think so?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I mean, insofar as they're still using Greek philosophical categories,
yeah.
Like that's a certain context.
Frame, uh-huh.
And he rebels against that, but I don't know.
He has that one, how Christians ought to read the Bible, something about Moses, that one passage where he talks about not everything is written for you. Some of it is specifically addressed to its own time period.
Mm.
For example, he says, he cites one of the old laws, Levitical laws or something like that, and he says, this was not addressed to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I always find that interesting.
Mm-hmm. So he had a little historical Jesus work thrown in there, or not Jesus, but historical context work in there. This idea of how you read the Bible is not only inflammatory in our church, but this fall we're going to have Marcus Borg come back to PLU, and he definitely is one of these historic Jesus people, scholars. And the last time he came, and we might be a different context at PLU now, but we had public demonstrations outside, both of the classrooms where he was teaching and then outside of his lecture. So,
did he have demonstrations for and against? Or?
I think just against. The four were probably in the room.
Yeah.
The person, his little co-comrade, John Dominic Crossan, he can get away with murder when it comes to everything, because he just has a sweet little accent and he's so friendly. And he just doesn't look as mean as Marcus Borg. So he says all these inflammatory things and people just roll with it, you know, like, oh, jolly Irishman, you know. It's like, you know, I'm like, good heavens. You know, you would be crucified up here if you were, you know, a Borg. People would be jumping down your throat. And he's so nice about it, you know. Yeah.
Well, about Borg, he is named Borg, and we've all watched Star Trek. So what does being a confessional tradition have to do with this, with the reading and stuff? Doesn't that impact?
Yeah, who? Someone else brought this up.
I didn't.
You did.
Yeah.
Well, you could answer that more, because it's not, you know, I think that's a bit different than the Sola Scriptura, but...
And I think that does come out of context. The confessional,
mm-hmm.
the circumstances which elicit one's confession, you know, came out of the context of the Reformation, it came out of the context of Nazi Germany, it came out of South Africa, it came out of the Civil Rights Movement. So that is very, that is contextual theology in terms of, if you put it in that, from that perspective, confessional theology is contextual theology in that sense, I would say. That.
And that would be a fascinating thing to have more a part of the conversation. I do not hear it as a part of modern church arguments in the last 10 years. That's all. I have not heard people arguing about that as much. This is clearly, sola scriptura has become a dividing factor.
One can see how having a confessional tradition could be a parameter for sola scriptura,
mm-hmm.
of how we interpret it, of saying there's a rule of faith, and that you just don't take it and read it and make it mean whatever you think it means, but you need to listen to their confession,
mm-hmm.
and let that impact you.
At the church.
And so in a sense that is... it's kind of another way of slipping in tradition.
Yeah.
Pay attention to tradition, but we'll pay attention to the confessions, which are our tradition.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking when I was listening to you, thinking if you put it in those terms, I think Lutherans would listen. But tradition might be a little scary. But even though do we not use tradition, there is a bit of a, of course, we're influenced by those who are around us and the confession of our church, and then with that, it's there. It was only that we had talked about, we didn't use the word confession, but at the bishops, we had to talk about, with the ELCA Task Force on Human Sexuality, I had to present to the Conference of Bishops and bring forward some of the theological ideas of Galatians and things that we were working with, and, you know, to get conversation. And this was in draft phase and in the third thing. not a perfect document by any means, any of it, but I mentioned the word experience, and poor Bishop Mark Hansen just about leapt out of his skin. Like, as soon as there was a break, he said, "Oh no, you've said experience." And I thought, "What? What? You know, what?" He said, "Oh, experience is so problematic." Because right now, and I thought, really, like of all theologians, really Augustine and Luther, there's nobody who writes their own experience into their theology more than these men. No theologian. Thomas Aquinas, it's all like from the sky on down, you know. Luther's talking about his ripped pants and, you know, talking about it theologically. It's like, and his digestive issues. It's like, good heavens, man. Like, nobody wants to hear this. You know, keep it to yourself. And so every occasion he has, he talks about theologically. Every moment of his life, and same with Augustine in the Confessions, it's like, good grief. So it is funny that Lutherans can't talk about experience when we've got Luther. That's the only thing that I just thought, I don't get it, really. I know the Sola Scriptura clearly, you know, but I don't get it because Luther is so into his own experience. But experience was the word that was being used to let the gays and lesbians into the church. Because if you have to honor experience.
In parentheses, there you see literal reading and then out of context with scripture. All right.
What am I talking about there?
Yeah. I mean, is somebody just saying, throw this and this and this, but just give me this piece and this piece?
Yes. I think when it's used in exclusion, that's it. I know there was no explanation, so I'm actually glad I put that in there because I was thinking, yeah, we should read things. I mean, we need to take it seriously, what it actually just says on the page. But what if I also know that this book says something different than that, and then this one down the line has a different angle on that, and Paul, is he for women, against women, which are Paul's writings, which are other writings, doesn't even matter. There's all that context of, like, what does this verse mean in the context of the Bible? And is it, so there was a congressperson once who on National Public Radio said, like it says in the Bible, if you don't work, you don't eat. And I'm thinking, what? So here's a verse. If it says it somewhere in the Bible, I was thinking there's more about feeding the hungry, I think, than if you don't work, you don't eat. So I was thinking that is an so out of context would be that kind of proof texting without caring. Like, I've got the words.
And how do you know when you're reading, say, something in Paul?
Yeah.
That seems to say no way, Jose, to the female side.
Exactly.
How do you know that this is out of context or not, quote unquote, the Word of God? I mean, how do you know that?
Right, and I think that was even, I was thinking about this earlier because, what's her name? Henricks. Sarah Henricks. Of Luther Seminary, who's the New Testament, you know, she works a lot with Paul. She talks about the multiple sides of Paul, that Paul in this breath is saying this, but in this breath is advocating these kind of leaders and things. I think if you have, for me personally, so I think we'd all have different ways of adjudicating this, right? But if, for me personally, if I know several things, I'll go with the weight on a number of things of saying, feeding the hungry, the orphan, the widow, these seem to be repeated again and again and again and again. You know, this is something that seems to be a standard. And then you have the things that come up occasionally. And in Paul's letters, I think there are those quotes where I think if people want to approach the scripture like that, then they have to go with it. There are those points, however, that I guess, John, I guess self-awareness of where I apply, because I am willing to apply literalism when it backs me up. Listen, so I'm a little more cautious of it now because I used to do that for, you know, you shall not kill, you know, like a pacifist stance. I was willing to haul out and literalize those verses, but when it came to women's leadership in the church, I wouldn't. So I think self-awareness even of when I'm literal and when I'm not is helpful to me, because I think we all do that. We pick pieces. Divorce flew, the fact that pastors could get divorced and still remain pastors, flew through, there was not even a church vote. It wasn't even, it was just adopted. And there are verses against for Jesus. Jesus is saying it, you know? So I think we literalize certain things. So I guess it's a messy answer to that, but I think the problem is that it's easier My sister-in-law got a much quicker answer from her pastor about why women can't be. I wrote out this big long thing, and he just says, it says in this verse in Paul. And he pulled one verse out, and that was the end, and she went with that. And I was like, wait, but I wrote that whole thing for you. Yeah, it just didn't matter. So it's an ace up the sleeve that can really work sometimes. We only have a couple minutes, so I'll throw out a couple more ideas. The total depravity, the idea that you're simultaneously justified and sinner. I don't know. This one, the I've fallen and I can't get up. So Luther's idea is on the left. Humans are born fallen. The idea of total depravity, die fallen. We're all bums. No one's better than another. Human nature is fundamentally broken. There's some part of that that is kind of a nice thing to cling to, because nobody wants to be guilty anymore, and no one wants to be told that they're not, that they, you know, there's a lot of cultural stuff around preserving my self-worth and independence and integrity, almost to an extent that you wonder if that's kind of a sickness of ours. On the other hand, some have raised that these ideas about this fundamental fallenness, and I'm a sinner, and I'm broken, and I can't get up, for people who are oppressed or abused, that question of, like, can this idea further oppress or bring about more pain? Some feminist theologians, I put their names, this Susan Nelson, Valerie Saving, had said sin or self-pride, for example, and that idea of defense of self has never been women's issue. This was a long time ago they wrote this, of saying pride is a man's issue. At least it was then. They said, women have, their issue is lack of self and lack of pride. And that's sin. So for women, that sinfulness is the lack of self. And for men, it might be being full of self. But then you're not looking at all the men that exist in the world. You're looking at only the powerful, right? So it's denying the experience of many men who would not feel empowered as well. So, but they kind of talk about, they're trying to talk about, I think they would have issues with the total depravity idea in Lutheran thought. Last two quick ones, and then, wow, you can't even see that. Sorry. Luther, the law has these primary meanings or functions. It shouldn't be dark purple in the background, is the problem. I can read it on your sheet if you have it. It says Luther's idea, the law has two primary meanings or functions, the political, civic, and the theological. It shows us shortcomings, ways we don't meet what ought to be. And in its best understanding, the law demands honesty about the world and self in its fallen condition. Meaning, the idea is to not let us hide in kind of self delusion of thinking that we're just fine and good. And when we really need to be called on the carpet about things. And that calling people on the carpet about things honestly could also be a positive thing for domestic violence too, right? I mean, you could see that it could function if that was the issue. Some of the potential issues is, I think that law-gospel dynamic I had written on the board one of the sessions can mimic that of domestic violence. I had said the other day, it's just burned into my memory that my Lutheran preaching professor said that the function of the pastor preaching was to drive the congregation to their knees and make them need the gospel. And that was, and I had said, was right after walking out of a pastoral care and counseling with women class where we talked about domestic violence cycles, of the idea of getting beaten up, and then the makeup session is so nice, and that you get caught in that beating up and making up and beating up and making up. And looking at Luther's own weird life with he's afraid of God's wrath and anger, and then he comes to this glorious realization of grace. There are some times that I wonder whether Luther himself, I've never written it anywhere, but whether he himself is kind of steeped in that tradition of violence and makeup. So he comes up with this law that accuses, and when Lutheran theologians get going on that in history, there are times it's, you know, it's a hammer, it's an axe, it shatters, it crushes, it murders, the law does, destroys you. Then comes the voice of the gospel, and there has to be gospel in the sermon, But it's a, it at least for me, and I think I'm the only one that has been a little obsessed about this, but I'm concerned. So I'll tell you all that. I am going to write something on this because I think, not sure about that. So I think it's a problem if it's us doing it to another person. I'm going to perform the law on you. But if we say, let's look at where we are and use the law as a measure of where we should be and want to be with all our hearts, that can be, if it's descriptive of talking about fallenness but not a action of the person in power, maybe it has something to offer. It can also be used, I think, as a kind of a weapon against other church members, saying, like, you need a good dose of the law, because I'm going to tell you what ought to be, and what we're forgetting here is the law. And when people say that, I do think, all right, where are you going? How are you understanding the law, and where are you going with that as a Lutheran? And for whom do you think the law needs to be called down? Is it you, or is it that person? You know, and then when it's, you know, when it's used against another person, it also is a little, it's God's law, and we're supposed to preach it. Oh, there's a lot of different kinds of issues in there. I had one more thing, and then we're at 5 o'clock, but the two kingdoms distinction. You have kingdoms under God, spiritual kingdoms, temporal kingdoms. They're described on the worksheet. Some of the issues I was thinking, actually I was like, does this have any problems? Maybe not. And then I thought, oh, what have I read for 40 years? Okay, so the assumptions even behind the doctrine concerning power, what has been around for 40 years that I've been reading for 20 plus, is what I should say. The assumptions behind this doctrine concerning power and dualistic thinking have been challenged by feminist theologians for 30 years. The kingly sovereign ideas of God as patriarchal enforcing earthly hierarchical power and orders over creation. Feminist theology has offered more relational understandings of God's power and supported those. Dualistic thinking, that separation of body and spirit, body and soul, spirit and earthly matters as though they can be distinguished and separated. And sometimes this kind of leads to dualistic thinking, false gendered associations for women and men, meaning it was in college I was told, well, you're a woman, you're all connected to the earth and intuitive and all of that. And I had never, no one had ever told me this. I just remember being like, what? Like, it was like you just called me a horse or something. Like, it was like this description you've never heard of yourself. It's like, what are you talking about? Me? Oh, and you're not? What? What are you? I'm abstract and I am, you know, civilization and culture. I was like, I don't get it. You know, so I had to read more. Luther's orders of creation definitely have women's subordination as a part of God's plan. Karl Grotten is entirely right on that. That's in Luther's writing. So if Luther is our, if Luther's estates and orders, when it comes to the temporal kingdoms, are what we want to follow, well then, we need to follow them. And that would have a different family structure than I'm living in. But I don't plan to do it. So there I go. Those are a couple of these ideas. I'm sorry, it's a lot of content and a lot of different things. I'm willing to stay around for a little while and talk if you'd like to. But I also want to just say that people are welcome to, you know, get up and leave and go to dinner and things like that.